Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. So this week, we tried something a little different. Sagar pivoted from co-host of The Realignment to guest, along with his other co-host, Crystal. It was really great. I got to grow both of them, and they actually got to grow each other a bit. Whether you agree or disagree with the populist left and the populist right, Bernie Sanders either won or came incredibly close to winning Iowa. And this episode is going to come out the same day of the New Hampshire primary, where he's favored to win. And Donald Trump, obviously, is president of the United States. So you have a situation where the populist left and the populist right, different sides of the same coin, and that they share a critique of American society, are possibly going to compete against one another. So with Crystal and Sagar, you have people who are articulating a shared critique of American society. They think that our economic, political, and cultural elites have failed for the past 30 or 40 years. But when it comes to that diagnosis, what's so interesting is they actually disagree about the actual cure. You're going to see them get into it on foreign policy, immigration, and drug policy and criminal justice. Ultimately, this show was really fun. It's a little longer than normal, but it was really great to see Sagar as a guest on the show with a little more time to talk, and then seeing how he and Krista, who are normally so synced up on the show, actually disagreeing about things a lot. So let's dive in. Crystal and Sagar, welcome to the podcast.
Wow, thank you, Marshall.
Thanks for having me.
So we're trying things a little differently this week because Sagar and Crystal actually have a book coming out next week. It's called The Populist Guide to 2020. So we're going to reverse things a bit. Sagar's going to be on the couch. I am the host.
Strange feeling.
He's going to cut in. But
I'm in the driver's seat normally.
This is an epic crossover as well.
This is the most ambitious crossover in American history.
Someone would say this is the real realignment
between
the Hill and our show. But your guys' book is about the new left and the new right. I think it'd be really helpful for our audience if you guys, just both from your own perspectives, define what you think, Crystal, the new left is, and what you think the new right is. Sagar, Crystal, let's hear it.
I think for me, the new left is a Democratic Party that actually puts the interests of the working class at the center. And the Democratic Party has itself undergone a realignment over the past number of decades, really starting first and foremost in the Clinton era, where there was a concerted push to reorient the party away from its FDR, New Deal, labor union roots and towards this rising professional managerial class. And the type of politics that we get around centering the Democratic Party on the professional managerial class is a politics that puts identity issues and cultural issues above, prioritizes them above economic issues. And fundamentally, I mean, in my view, they've sold the working class out to financial interests, to the sort of professional managerial class elite. So for me, the new left is really a reclamation of the Democratic Party back to its FDR roots, back to a more radical program in terms of economics and putting the interests of the working class at the center.
And Sagar, what's the new right?
Well, it's so funny. It's literally the exact same thing. And I think that's what Crystal and I talk about on the show, which is that the true bipartisanship in Washington is an embrace of financial capital and tax policy and financial policy and cultural policy and all these other things to the benefit of the moneyed professional elite, which have the most amount of influence in D.C. So what is the new right? It's a departure from the free market consensus that has broadly been established in the party since, Barry Goldwater in the 1960s. And it's a return to the idea that we put our population at the center of our policy. And that was the funny thing is about the new right is it's just the old right, which is that it's understanding that the true benefit of your life does not come down to how much GDP is growing. Now, that has some part of it, but it's not all of it. It's about your family, and it's about putting policy in place in order to make it so that you can live a successful and meaningful life with as many kids as you want to have wherever you want to live. Yeah. That's how it is.
And can I just say, Marshall, because to kind of tie those two ideas together, right? There's this idea that Washington is all gridlocked, right? That it's completely divided, no one gets along, et cetera, et cetera. That's an illusion in many respects. There is a bipartisan consensus. There's a consensus around elevating those who are, you know, elite in terms of money, in terms of power, et cetera, that leads to a consensus around deregulation, a consensus around lowering taxes, a consensus around war making, right? Regime change wars. There's a massive bipartisan consensus around that. So I think what Sagar and I are exploring in the book and what we explore on Rising is what would it look like if instead of fighting for, you know, the big donor class, what if the two parties were fighting over support for working class people? What would that new politics look like? Where would be the new areas of consensus and the new areas of division?
Yeah. So what's interesting for me is that not only do you guys share a shared narrative of sort of the working class and class politics being subordinated, but you also share a shared historical timeline. Mm-hmm. So what you're basically saying is in the 60s and 70s, you had a transition from the old right and you had a transition from the FDR model. But to play devil's advocate, that old model was transitioned away for a reason. It wasn't just a conspiracy. There were people who argued that the Democratic Party was losing elections. The Democratic Party was only in favor of overwhelming regulation when you had things like the airlines and you had things like tax policy that was so that was in need of sort of rejigging. What do you think your movement responds to that critique with?
I think that, I mean, first of all, this all requires a lot of historical context, right? We're in a very, very different moment now. But basically, the idea that we are being fed, that you're sort of arguing for here, is that the way that Democrats have to win is by moving to the center, right? That there was too much excesses of the left, that we had to come back to the center in order to regain power. And I think there was some reality to that at the time. But now we've gone so far in the other direction that it just doesn't bear out anymore. I mean, look, we ran the centrist candidate last time in Hillary Clinton. We had a centrist administration in Barack Obama. Meanwhile, Democrats lost 1,000 plus state legislative seats, governor's mansions, the House, ultimately the Senate. So this idea that the thing that people want is cultural liberalism plus economic corporatism is the exact opposite of what the polls and the results actually indicate.
Yeah. Yeah. So Sagar, at what point do you jump off the train, right? Because as Chris was pointing out, there's this argument for pushing things to the left, for sort of embracing radical politics. But there are areas where, if you look at your program, I think that radicalness would be a problem. So where in your view do the populists right and where do they disagree?
I think they disagree on the solutions. And that's what Crystal and I talk about all the time, is the reason that we can get this. This is the funny thing, is when we're talking about bipartisanship and all of that, is that one of the things that is bipartisan is about the way that norms are set in Washington. And both Crystal and I have no worship of civility politics or norms, or like the, you know, worshiping at the altar of 30-year-old traditions. Where I jump off, or where I think we both jump off, is on different points about what to do about it whenever it comes to like labor markets. Now, I argue for a tight labor market, which requires immigration restriction. Crystal, you know, departs from that and saying that we need less of a scarcity mindset and to think about more in terms of uniting the entire working class, which includes illegal immigrant populations. So to me, it's much more about how we look at the population, how we are thinking about how to boost the economic wages and truly contribute to a quality of life. But it's the same diagnosis. It's about the solution on there that I think is the issue. And when you strip away so much of the astroturfed politic of the left and the right whenever it comes to identity, that is what we are arguing about here. And that's what we're arguing about in the book.
Yeah. And there's also a fetishization of Trump that has occurred on both the left and the right, right? On the left, and you see this in the mainstream cable networks, almost literally every story is framed around like Trump is bad. And over on Fox News, almost every story is framed around Trump is good, right? Which is an incredibly simplistic narrative that ignores all of the underlying dynamics that brought Donald Trump to be president of the United States in the first place, which I think are far more interesting and important to dissect than, you know, whether Nancy Pelosi ripped his speech up or all those sorts of things that tend to be the fixation on cable news every day. And the reason that I know that, and the reason why I'm sure your listeners and our viewers over on Rising are interested in this, is because Trump is not an isolated phenomenon. I mean, you look around the world and you see this neoliberal world order of the past several decades collapsing before our very eyes, and mass citizen movements in literally every corner of the globe. So What is the common thread between all of these places? What are all these people have in common? What are they rebelling against? And then what we start to try to get to in the book is, what might they be moving towards, right? Yeah. What does that, and that's the focus of your podcast, obviously, what does that realignment ultimately lead us to in the best possible scenarios, where you have people who are genuinely well-intentioned and actually, you know, have some idealism and believe in principles and actually want to do something that'll be positive for the citizens of this nation and the world and the working class citizens of this country in particular? What could that look like in the best case scenario?
Yeah, and I think I came across this bullet point of one of your monologues, I think explains your political viewpoint, which said, ditch Ukraine, embrace class, in terms of like the way that the Democratic Party should conceive of the way moving forward. But so this is I think what would be helpful for listeners is to sort of draw into the points of agreement. So like Sagar said, the frameworks, really. So it's a shared critique. So I think the first one that I sort of teased out from reading the book was establishment failure in two specific areas. Economic policy and foreign policy. So on the economic policy side, I'll jump in, then let me know what y'all think. I think that your critique would be, we've been seeing a trade policy that has deindustrialized the Midwest and sort of prevented the working class from embracing sort of the benefits of globalization. You've had stagnant wages. You've also had a system that doesn't actually enable workers to bargain or participate. Is that, would you guys agree with that framework?
Yeah, I think we that's both fair. Agree with that.
And what is there anywhere where you guys have disagreed on that then?
In terms of the economic diagnosis?
Yeah.
I'm not sure, Crystal. I mean, I think both of us look at it as, I think we probably argue around like the margins of some of these things, but broadly, what does it mean? You know, on trade and automation, I think that's one where we had argued about it during the Andrew Yang kerfuffle with Elizabeth Warren. But ultimately, I mean, automation and the corporate consensus and all the money that's driving it is the same moneyed interest that led to the trade policy in which to ship American jobs to China and to Mexico in order to manufacture low-cost goods, which is what do both of those things come at the ultimate expense of, which is an American worker who previously was able to sustain a middle-class family lifestyle on that. And I just refuse, I think we both refuse, to accept the inevitability of these types of arguments and say no, that there is a role for people to play in defending their livelihood and that the government can play that role. Obviously, that's a departure mostly for me on the right in order to make that argument, but I'm not sure, Crystal.
It's a departure from the neoliberal worldview as well to put, I mean, I'm extraordinarily pro-union. And I think if you look at history and you look at the economic numbers, when the middle class really started to see their share of the national income decline and when productivity continued to go up, but workers stopped benefiting, was when unions really came under attack. Now, that was launched initially by the right, but there are plenty of anti-union Democrats out there, certainly to this day, and that was another sort of Clinton era situation. Certainly, the Democratic Party has not prioritized the labor movement. And I see that as actually, in a sense, a market mechanism to give workers power. Any individual worker in their workplace is just going to get crushed. I mean, you just have no hope as one sales associate working at Walmart that you're ever going to get a fair shake. The only power for working class people truly comes from their numbers and from that ethos of solidarity within the labor movement. So again, you asked about sort of excesses, you know, that there was a backlash against. Were there excesses with unions? Of course there were. But I think that was more of a narrative in order to crush a movement that actually gave working class people some power in their workplace that didn't require like a big government solution, right? This was each individual shop and local union having their own negotiations and coming to what they felt was a fair deal for their members. That ethos, I think, is incredibly important to put back at the center of American politics and American life. It's also, you know, something Sagar talks about a lot, that importance of community that I think Democrats have underestimated and undervalued very much in recent years. One of the important community institutions that brought together people of different races, religions, backgrounds, et cetera, was the Union Hall, people of differing political beliefs too, interacting and having to actually work, grind through like the mechanisms of consensus, was the Union Hall. And the fact that that's been decimated has been a massive loss for our economy, for the working class, and really for the health of our communities too. Mm.
Sagar, as a member of the American right, how do you think about the union question? Mm. Because on our first episode of the season, J.D. Vance, so noted conservative, he specifically talked about how he opposed sort of policies would be seen as anti-union. And that's another one of those changes on the right. I think there's still skepticism of public sector unions on the right now, but I think increasingly you're seeing people like Orrin Cass and yourself and JD talking this way.
Well, because I mean, to borrow very much from the great Michael Lind from season 2, episode 1 here, which is that it's all about settlement of these differences. How do we reach settlement? We have to give the working class power. Right now, the only power they have in our society is the vote. And when you rob people of power for decades and you give them, then that's how you end up with the Donald Trump. That's how you end up with the Bernie Sanders. These are people who are so far pushing past the Overton window that they are fighting from the extremist position simply to bring you back a modicum of power in your lives. So when I think about unions, that's what I think about, which is that it is one of the facets of that community that you're talking about, is we need to build up the pillars of our society which encourage both the ability for workers to express power, the ability for them to have a sense of belonging and power in their communities, especially when we think about churches and the decline of family institutions and all of these other extra-governmental organizations and institutions. That's how you take power off the government. You know, these right free market-obsessed conservatives who talk about limiting government power at all use are really trying to limit the last tool that the working class has in order to express power in our society, because they don't have economic power. They don't have cultural power. The last thing they possibly could have is government power. And then their so-called brethren are trying to take that away from them.
So I think that you've used power so many times that I have to ask the power question. If you watch your guys' show and you read your book, a concept that is just pretty missing is like the question of identity politics and a focus on identity over
there's a takedown of it in the book.
So why, it's not that you guys are uninterested in questions of race and identity, but why does a focus on class and power seems to be you're suggesting that's more important?
Well, and here's my view, and then I'll let Sagar explain his, which may be a little bit different. But look, racism, sexism, ageism, all bigotry is real, right? Don't get me wrong about that. And also don't get me wrong about the fact that it does matter. It did matter to have the first Black president in office and for little kids to be able to see that and believe that for themselves, the highest office in the land was achievable and possible. Or Mayor Pete is the first gay candidate to,
to win the Iowa caucus.
Win Iowa, well, according maybe. To the media, yeah. We'll yeah. see. Yeah. look, that's a meaningful victory. However, it is also true that those trailblazing identities are often used to mask a status quo politics that disproportionately harms the very identity groups that they claim to be supporting. So, for example, does it really matter to you as a Black woman if it is Kamala Harris, a Black woman, who is prosecuting you in California because your kid was truant or because you were caught with possessing marijuana? Right? Does it make it better that she's a Black? Like, is that really the change you're looking for? Right? Or Mayor Pete? He's never going to get elected president, but if he were to, right? Just imagine, it's not going to be any different for it's the same status quo policies. So the vulnerable groups that they tend to be supporting by fixating just on one individual person's identity, those are the groups that are most are often harmed. One of the things that we talk about specifically in the book that I think is a perfect example is when AOC endorsed Bernie Sanders, right? Now, AOC is a working class woman herself, right? Was a bartender and then made it to Congress. And her politics are very class centric, right? But she has a lot of fans who loved her more for her sort of girl power, young woman of color identity than actually fully understood or embraced her politics. So when she endorsed the quote unquote old white guy over the slightly younger woman in the race, there was kind of a meltdown of white feminists who were like, how could you? Right? How could you? Because they could not get that Sanders' politics were different, that it was important that he was putting class at the center, and that they believed, that she believes, that type of politics will be more beneficial to young women of color, working class young women of color, like her, like, you know, like the background that she grew up as. That was just totally foreign to them. So what I see is a weaponization of identity often on the left, where that is meant to be the end all be all and policies are sort of secondary. It's a way of preserving the status quo for the people who hold power currently.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. I think I just take a much more cynical view, which is that
surprise.
Yeah. Anybody listening to this, I think it's a concerted effort that began in the university and the academia in order to birth an ideology that, when paired, I don't think they intentionally wanted to marry critical race theory with capital.
So it's not there's no conspiracy.
I don't think there was a conspiracy, but it did happen.
But that's what they did.
So essentially what happened is that accumulated capital understood that a way to buy off the identitarian left was to simply embrace their identity so that they don't ask questions about their supply chains in China, so that they don't ask questions about shipping jobs overseas, so that they don't ask questions. They basically bought off a huge segment of the media and the elite class by sponsoring these critical race theory events. And I take a much more kind of Tucker Carlson view of it, which is, at this point, I now think it's intentional. I don't think it began that way. I think it was a very rational choice on both. You know, the critical race theorists believe that race and identity wars in America are in and of themselves the most important conflict. So whenever Goldman Sachs and a bunch of other banks decided to sponsor events on that, they said, hey, we'll take it, because any ally in the race war is an ally of mine. But to me now, I do think it is cynical. It is used in order to pit people against each other, away from advocating for their actual interests. And it is very much a top-down effort in order to change the Overton window on a whole host of different cultural issues, on people who just want to live their lives and are a blown tire away from bankruptcy. And that is very much how I see it.
And so what do you see? On the right, you see a weaponization of white identity. So you like sort of throw those bones of the culture war to the white working class and then, you know, cut the taxes of corporations so that you have more Fortune 500 companies paying zero in taxes than ever before. And on the left, you see a similar throwing of sort of cultural identity bones to the black and brown working class. So you can just say, well, at least we're not racist like those people. Meanwhile, Rahm Emanuel, tell us all about what we should be doing on healthcare. Hey, Mike Bloomberg, why don't you just buy your way into this race? You know, there's a complete, it's as long as we pander to you on your identity, then we can sell you out in whatever way we want. You see it very clearly with Silicon Valley companies. You know, where it always drives me crazy when they're just sort of lazily labeled on the left. So I'm like, do you know how Amazon treats their workers? Like, do you know how they just destroy any attempt at unionization? Do you know how they're trying to automate their workforce out of existence? How their people working in warehouses, their blue collar workers have to wear diapers because they don't get bathroom breaks? That is not a leftist ideology. That's not a progressive ideology. But because these companies are good at virtue signaling on certain identity issues, they get this blanket, you know, oh, they're on the left, they're allies, they're progressive, they're moving against the status quo, when nothing could be further than the truth. They are corporatist, and they have seen it in the best interest of their bottom line to embrace certain virtue signaling elements of the left, but they are not allies to anyone.
So I think if we stopped the show here, one would conclude that we're sort of right on the verge of a left-right horseshoe that's skeptical of the establishment, that's skeptical of the sort of mainstream media, and wants to focus on power. But as Sagar, you talked about, the problem is that this all sort of falls apart, or at least becomes a little difficult when we start talking about the actual solutions.
Sure.
So I think in this last section, I really want to focus on the areas of disagreement, because I think you've given a very useful way of thinking about, okay, so if someone is on the new right or the new left, how would they look at the world? How would they diagnose the problem? The issue then is going to be the solution. So firstly, foreign policy and the question of nationalism. Like, Sagar, like, obviously this is a huge point. Now, Crystal, I think everyone's going to know that Sagar would embrace the idea of nationalism. But how do you think about the whether nationalism in of itself is a good idea, is a bad idea. Like, what are your thoughts on that topic?
So my thoughts on that, and this is definitely where we diverge. And frankly, I think if it does end up being a Trump-Bernie matchup, I think you'll see a lot more discussion of this on Rising, which is going to be...
But principled and good.
You're principled and good, yes. Not like, you're a racist. Yeah. Et cetera, et cetera. Why do you hate America?
Right.
That's what you would say to me, right?
Yes.
So, look, I think the whole idea that the source of problems for working class people is other working class people is completely bogus.
So you're referring to immigrants then?
Exactly. And I think the idea that we don't have enough to go around, a scarcity mindset, which would say, you know, oh, we can't possibly give healthcare to people. We can't possibly welcome refugees into our country. We can't possibly have any more low-skilled workers come in. I think that that is yet another cynical attempt to weaponize and turn and divide working class people one against another. Look, poverty is a tool of control, social control. It's a choice. In a wealthy country like ours, it's a complete choice. And we could make other choices. So what I will say is I do not think it is fundamentally racist, especially if you're a working class person, to look around and say, I don't even have health care, right? Let's take care of the people here before we take care of people who are trying to come here. I think that's completely fair and legitimate. And I do think that there is a sequencing of these things that you should prioritize your own citizens. I completely agree with that. I wouldn't argue with it for one second. But the idea that I hear coming in particular from this administration, from right-wing administrations around the world, that would say, look, don't pay attention to the structure of our capitalist system here. The real thing that's screwing you is the brown people who are coming in from across our borders. That's the thing that's breaking down your community. That's the thing you need to worry about. I just completely reject that.
Sorry, I get the sense that you completely reject everything she just said.
Well,
so
it's more on like my thing is always about order of operations. So it's like, and people who listen to our debate with Bhaskar Sunkara, they know this, is that whenever it comes on immigration, is that I see much more, in terms of practicality, is that we know amnesty always comes first, and then actual protections and all these other things come later. So on a practical level, I can agree with what you're saying. It's just whenever it comes to me, it's like, what I want is a tight labor market. And I actually still believe...
Like you define a tight labor market.
Which is what a tight labor market is, when you have a... limited less supply of workers relative to the jobs, which naturally increases the wages. Now, I think there should be some government, you know, whatever, whenever it comes to some of these wages, but that overall, a lot of it, you know, there is a market. Markets are not terrible all the time. People listen to our Megan McArdle episode can go and listen to a very good articulation there. So where I come down on is about order of operations, and I just know that the way that these things always work out is to the benefit of a large number of low-skilled workers coming into the country without any of the protections that almost always are set to follow, especially in the American political system. The benefits to so many Fortune 500 companies. There's a reason that E-Verify has not been passed across the United States. There's a reason that Ron DeSantis, who's the most popular governor, realignment Republican governor in America, cannot even pass E-Verify in Florida with a 75% approval rating. That shows you how much moneyed interest is behind actually protecting wages in America. So from that perspective is where I depart. I think the other main thing, Marshall, you brought this up on foreign policy, and I think this is where Crystal and I also diverge, which is like, I am not for like a multipolar world. And a lot of socialists that I've argued with, they are very comfortable and okay with multipolarity. I mean, they've laughed at me.
So what is a multipolar?
Right. So they've laughed at me when I'm like, God, we'll be doomed to Europe. And they're like, oh, well, in Europe, they have healthcare. And I'm like, yeah, but they also have no say over the global affairs of the world. I want to write the affairs of the world, the rules of the road. I want to be the only blue water navy. I don't want the Chinese ruling the Straits of Malacca and the South China Seas, because I believe America, for me, it's about freedom. America and American citizens are less free with a global authoritarian superpower like China that is rising in the East. Whereas what the socialists that I've talked to has been very much more we should focus on here at home. All global power projection is bad. I completely disagree with that. And I think that one of the ways that I'm misread is when people say, oh, well, you're an isolationist because you're, you know, you advocate for less of a posture in Iraq and Afghanistan. As I'm like, what I want is to turn that ship around. I want to turn that ship over to the east, you know, to the east and towards China. I want, you know, our, if at least we're going to have a military industrial complex, let it be good at what it does and compete against China instead of billing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of equipment in order to kill people who are using AK-47s. Mine is much less of a critique of American power writ large and more about the way that it's been managed by this technocratic class and used over the last 30 to 40 years.
Crystal. Yeah. I mean, so this is interesting because when you talk to people on the left, and you see this in the comments section, whenever Sagar talks about this, there's a lot of talk about, well, in 1953, we did Mossadegh. And then in the 1980s, we were involved in Central America. There's all sorts of debates that would be 15 different podcasts about what happened in the 20th century. But I think something people are going to be skeptical of, especially in a Bernie Sanders campaign and maybe even a presidency, is what does the left have to say about foreign policy moving forward? Because Sagar's not coming here saying we should be fighting, you know, the Sandinistas.
Right.
Sagar's saying what we should be doing is having a strong navy against China. So how do you think about the future looking forward, looking foreign policy questions?
Well, I do think you have to, though, talk a little bit about the past, because the reality is that many of those efforts to project our power have weakened us. I mean, obviously, the Iraq War is the perfect example, right? Probably the greatest strategic blunder, certainly in my lifetime, where we spent so much money, lost so many lives, destabilized an entire region of the world, and really at an absolutely critical juncture in our nation's history when we should have been preparing for the job losses and the transition to sort of a two-tiered economy, et cetera. So one of the things that I'm just very careful about and very skeptical of and very wary of is oftentimes throughout our history, when we go to project power around the world, it actually ends up making us weaker and less safe. You know, I can't speak for Bernie Sanders exactly, but I'm not sure that he would fundamentally disagree with anything that Sagar just said. I mean, he alone in the Democratic Party was talking about China and the danger to the American middle class when that was not a cool thing to be doing. You know, Donald Trump himself said that he was on that hot mic, that he was worried about running against Bernie because he was right on trade. So I think that with Sanders, there's a commitment to engaging diplomatically. I think, you know, in a way that is not fundamentally dissimilar from Trump in certain ways, but hopefully with more preparation, planning, less ego, less about the photo op and more about the results. But I think he would advocate for, and I would advocate for, a policy that focuses on engagement and diplomacy first and foremost, long before you ever get to any sort of hot conflict. And I know everybody says that, but almost no one means it. Mm. You know, it's why Tulsi Gabbard is so completely vilified, that she would actually go and walk the walk and meet with a Bashar al-Assad, which was in certain ways very naive of her to do, but also very consistent with her principles of engagement first. I think that's always the way that you have to go. And I mean, you see that that's an area of difference between Sagar and I. Like, I think that the Iranian nuclear deal was maybe the greatest accomplishment of the Obama administration, an administration that I am incredibly critical of. I think that was a much better direction to be going in than the direction we're currently heading in, which will end up with, if we get even can get to negotiations with them again, we will get a much worse deal. And in the meantime, we have come very, very close to having an actual hot war with Iran, which I think would be completely disastrous.
Yeah, so I think that's actually a good pivot to an area of particular contention, especially between the two of you, which is drug policy and crime. Obviously, something that's interesting is that the way that I would sort of define a lot of the new right people is that they're not libertarian in their economics or their social or cultural views. So while a lot of the mainstream GOP, what, for example, former Speaker John Boehner, have embraced marijuana legalization and other sort of drug policy issues, that's something that Sagar and a lot of folks definitely have not embraced either. So Sagar, can you go into, like, what is your position on that topic?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that position has nothing to do with the money that's being paid to him to advocate for that position. But, and I'm sure it's, you know, based entirely on principles. Where I look at this is I look at the emerging drug consensus in the United States in terms of a libertine social agenda that ties back to what I was talking about with identity politics, that comes very much towards being pushed at the complete behest and the benefit of big business. We had Kevin Sebe on Rising, in which he talked about this is ultimately a bottom line benefit for Goldman Sachs and venture capital companies who are advocating A, to reduce FDA regulation and their ability to have any insight whatsoever into incredibly powerful mind-altering substances. People who listen to our John Walters episode here know that we're talking about drugs at some point with 40% THC, which is exponentially higher, based on my discussion with the Surgeon General and others, to anything that we've seen in modern times, like in the last 10 years. So the progression of this industry is such that we are essentially running a basic experiment of mind-altering substances upon millions and millions of young and developing brains, all towards a cultural agenda of so-called freedom, when I also think it's actually just a way in order to get people addicted and hooked on substances in order so that they can deal with the miserable economic conditions that govern their lives. I think it's still a control of, I think it's still a piece of power of accumulated capital and a lot of that in our society. And that is the difference I see on that is that we cannot as a culture say that it's okay for these things to be done. We cannot as a culture cede so many young people to using and fetishizing mind-altering substances, and that only the government, through its power, can de-incentivize that, keep it illegal. And this is the other thing I think we put a part on. I believe in the criminal justice system. I said on The Rising today.
Crystal doesn't.
Yeah, I know. Well, I know. I mean, I believe in the criminal. Mostly I said on Rising actually. Today, the thing that I am the most skeptical of is when people are bipartisan and both stand up clapping. What was one of the things? We're taping this on the day after the State of the Union. Criminal justice reform is where everybody stood up and started clapping. And I have to be just inherently skeptical of when I see a lot of people who have been wrong about everything whenever they agreed over the last 40 years think that these types of things are a good idea. So whenever I look at drug policy, there seems to be a lot of libertarian left crossover on criminal justice very much. I look at it as like, yeah, I think that there are bad people in society and they should be punished. I think bad behavior should also be punished. I have sympathy and I would be very willing to direct government resources at helping and diverting much of this, but a punishable element has to exist. So this is about how I view human nature and how I view like civilizations and how they should be governed.
Mass incarceration was the bipartisan consensus. I mean, Joe Biden partnered with, mm-hmm. The right to build the prison system that we have, which has weaponized. I mean, the criminal justice system has been weaponized against the poor. I mean, that's the reality. Being poor in America has been criminalized effectively, and that's not a race statement. That is across races. That's just a straight class fact. On drugs, first of all, we did have this debate a little bit on Rising.
Yes.
Your issue to me is more with the capitalist system than it is a critique of drug policy, because we have to look at the fact that, and I completely agree, we have to ask ourselves, why do we have the worst addiction crisis in our nation's history now? Now, when supposedly, unemployment is low and GDP is rising and we've been in this long expansion, et cetera, it's because we have been sold a bill of goods about how buying the next piece of cheap Chinese-made crap is going to make us happy, or maybe if we work more hours, or maybe if we take out another credit card, or maybe if we send more members of our family out into the workforce, that all of these things, ambition, careerism, and consumerism are going to make us happy, and it has left us nothing but miserable. Meanwhile, our communities have been sucked dry by the bipartisan consensus in Washington that prioritized GDP growth over community and solid middle class jobs. So that's why we have the crisis. That part I think that we very much agree on. We have to look at the fact of we've been interdicting heroin in this country for 100 years and it doesn't work. The people that you hand power to are the criminal, murderous drug cartels that have. You want to talk about the immigration crisis. A big part of why we have so many people who want to come here is because our drug war has destabilized country after country in Latin America. I mean, Mexico is like run by the drug cartels. That's all because of our drug policy. So interdiction and prohibition has failed. That is the bottom line. So if you look at Portugal as the prime example, look, they had a similar addiction crisis. They were known as the heroin capital of Europe, right? And rather than going in the direction of let's try to crack down harder, let's try to seize more drugs, let's focus on the supply side, they said, no, instead what we're going to do is we're going to actually treat this as a public health issue because that's what it is. We're going to decriminalize so that people anywhere, you know, rather than being thrown in prison, there are going to be safe injection sites where they can get help, they can get counseling, and they can go on with their lives. And that has worked miracles there. I mean, their addiction rate and their overdose rate is so much dramatically lower than ours and so much dramatically lower than where they were. It's been an incredible success. So we just have to look at what actually works. And the policy of the past 100 years of trying to cut off the supply chain has only empowered and enriched the murderous criminal drug cartels. Mm.
My response is, on Portugal in particular, is they still have an illegal drug market. It's not the same size as the United States. They don't have Mexico on their southern border. And whenever we come
there's
to
no
this...
There's no Chinese fentanyl.
There's a lot of different things there.
Well, they would have Chinese fentanyl if they hadn't taken a different approach. I mean, look, the drugs were getting there before this approach.
Right, so the way I'm looking at it now is that this current heroin crisis, John Walter said this here, I think it's the perfect way to look at it, is that the deaths rising are, it's not just a function of use going up, which it certainly is. It is a function of a mass poisoning largely by the Chinese government and an intentional facilitation of the production of fentanyl in order to poison and kill American citizens with the complicity of the Mexican government and the Mexican drug cartels. And that much of this actually comes down to the fact that the Obama administration essentially gave up whenever it came to real drug interdiction at the United States southern border, which exacerbated this, empowered Mexican drug cartels here in the United States. So what I'm advocating for is just to switch back to actually targeting these, using drug enforcement at the border, going after, and I'd commend the Trump administration for their signing of this accord, seeing if it's yet to be seen whether the full results of that are going to work out. I think we got some data for the first time that in 2019, things did drop off a little bit. However, the uniqueness of this crisis is not, in my mind, connected to the 100 years. It's connected to a very specific moment of empowered cartels, the Chinese government, and of fentanyl in particular. And what is missing from this, which is where we both agree on, how did all these people get addicted in the first place? It was through criminal behavior. Look, it's been proven, criminal behavior of pharmaceutical companies and the complicity of a lot of doctors and a lot of people and insurance companies who are making a whole lot of money profiting off of this. So I don't think there is that much of a disagreement. It's more about enforcement. I still believe in enforcement. I think that very much of that can happen. And I think it comes down to this. I think drugs are really bad. They're bad. And I think that they need to be discouraged and targeted as much as possible. In terms of incarceration, yeah, I agree. The way our criminal justice system has been applied has disproportionately affected the poor. It should be changed. I don't think people should. Whenever people hear I'm anti-marijuana, they think that I'm like in favor of some like street level dealer getting locked up for like a couple of ounces in his pocket. No, that's largely a tool of social control. I think that's bad. But that doesn't mean the drugs should be legal. And that is where I kind of come down on.
One last piece on this. Why is fentanyl a thing, right? No one really actually wants to take fentanyl, right? What has happened and the way that this addiction crisis spiraled out of control was, yes, you had criminal behavior by pharmaceutical companies in particular. And just, you know, this is like the corrupt rot of DC as well, where the FDA allowed OxyContin to be labeled as non-addictive and to be pushed to doctors who, you know, the easy thing for them to do and the way that they would get their extra golf trips or whatever was to addict the working class of America, which is what happened. And pharmaceutical companies were happy to cash in on that end to the tune of billions of dollars. And now, by the way, they're also happy to cash in on the other end by profiting from the, you know, the Narcan and the other drugs to try to deal with the problem. So that was how it started. Okay. And then once people got their prescriptions cut off from their doctors, because it was cheaper, they went to heroin. And now the iron law of prohibition is because you have to move things in secret, because your dealer's incentive is always to push the highest dose in the smallest quantity. That is why you have fentanyl. No one wants to take fentanyl. Right. And so as long as you have a prohibition policy focused on interdiction, focused only on the supply side, you will have poisons like fentanyl entering our society, you know, pushed by the Chinese government, pushed by the Mexican government, pushed by the cartels, whoever. But that is what enables that system to exist. And I don't think that, I don't think you could ever interdict enough drugs. And we've seen this over the past. I mean, the Obama administration had more resources on the border than anyone previously had had. But you cannot, you cannot fight it just by trying to control supply. It has never worked ever in history.
I think in our last section, what's so interesting to me is that this is an episode where half of the audience is going to hate what you said, Crystal. And I think the other half will hate what you said, Sagar, for a couple of different reasons. I think our center right neoconservative listeners will not be happy with you.
No, that's
right. But I just want to channel what I think they would say to the both of you. I'm just curious what your just sort of general sum up response would be. So you guys have this critique of a system which is really complicated. For the past 30 years, we've had to deal with the fall of the Soviet Union. We've had to deal with the 1990s. We've had to deal with globalization. There's all this sort of change. And it seems that you guys are doing a good job of critiquing specific decisions or complication. But when it comes to the actual solutions you're proposing, they would kill innovation, for example, increasing the cost of, increasing the size and cost of government. I mean, Sagar, like the reality of you basically saying that government's the only tool of helping people is that you're sort of not ignoring Social Security and our national debt. And obviously that, that critique would apply to you too, Crystal. So what do you say to your centrist, center-left, center-right neoliberal critics who basically argue that you guys are good at diagnosing but actually don't have any actual solutions that are going to be implemented? Wow. Because the last bit that I would add, though, is that we've had a sort of test case of this, which is we've had President Trump in D.C. for 3 years. Mm-hmm. He threw aside all these established institutions, the media, think tank world, the traditional senators and governors, yet we've had legislative stasis. We've seen implementation technocratic failures. Why is the future populist movement going to be something that could solve for that?
Well, the populism, this is where I look at Michael Lind again. Populism is a means. It's not an end. It's the beginning. It's not the end. What do we figure out on this podcast? We try to figure out serious policy solutions to legitimate populist problems. What, I think one thing Michael said was like, most populism ends up in charlatans, just buying the, buying off people and then like not actually doing anything.
And book sales.
True.
And book sales. I kind of agree.
Buy the book.
Yeah. I think that's actually true. And which is, I believe that, I said this on Tucker Carlson's show. I'm not anti-elite. I just want a better elite. And what I would say to the center and to the, any of the centrists who are watching is you don't have any solutions either. Is your solutions continue to make, like I use this phrase, blown tire away from bankruptcy. I think that's where a huge amount of our population is. Your solutions don't solve for that. Increasing GDP to like 9% a year or whatever by growth still wouldn't solve for that, just the way that the economy is structured. And so, you know, it's on both of us to actually innovate. If you want a real marketplace of ideas and all of that, you're operating in a space where we know the exact market failures that happen, and these have real impact on people's lives. So what I would say is, yeah, I don't think that just going up there and shouting your way to the White House is a way to do it. In fact, many, you know, anybody who knows me knows that my biggest critiques of the Trump administration and of the Trump movement, of the populist right, all of that, is that they don't have enough serious people who are lawyers, who know how to do anything, who know how to rake policy into actual executive orders, and that much of the competence, where has Trump succeeded the most? In the judiciary. Why did that happen? Because there has been a 40-year concerted organizational effort in order to professionalize judicial nominees for the right, a pipeline of institutions and talent. None of that exists. Like I said, I'm not anti-elite. I want a better elite. And I would say to them is that we know exactly what happens if we go down your road. Maybe we should start thinking about a new one.
Yeah. A couple things. First of all, I actually don't. So the critique that I get is that your ideas aren't possible, right? Washington is gridlocked. It's not possible. Is more the critique I get than you don't have solutions, because the reality is they're afraid of the solutions because the solutions would undermine their power, right? If you have Medicare for all, for example, then the health insurance industry is not very happy and they no longer have a seat at the table. They can no longer like profit off the illness of the nation. So they don't like the solutions, and the barrier they try to throw up because the people like the solutions, at least in the Democratic Party, is that it's not, quote unquote, not possible. But let me sketch out an alternative history of the Trump administration. it was all there for Donald Trump. If he had played his cards differently, look, his approval rating is pretty good right now, highest it's been in his administration. He could have had a 65% approval rating, and Democrats would have been powerless to stop him. All he had to do was, from the beginning, if he had opened up the purse strings, if he had put an infrastructure project in every district in this country and started with actual measurable results for the working class, not this part of the working class or that part of the working class, and let's disenfranchise this part of the working class, but actual material, I see how this improves my life, which it was all there for him. Democrats would have had to work with him. I promise you they would have. Look, they just gave him his freaking trade deal day after they impeached him. That's how weak they are. He would be in a very, very different place now, because the reality is that, and this is, I think, this is kind of the thesis of the book, and the success of the book proves the thesis, that all this idea of elite power and gatekeepers and institutional power, it is all a mirage. It's all gone. Saul Alinsky, if I may quote, in Rules for Radicals, talks about how if you make any issue hot enough, politicians have to move. The one thing that the working class has is numbers. And a lot of the conversation and a lot of the messaging that comes out of DC is all about how you are powerless, when the opposite is entirely the case. So if you have a movement that is focused not on, let me get the experts together in DC, and not on, let me negotiate with Mitch McConnell, and not on what is the art of the possible with these assholes that I have to deal with right here.
We're going to have to edit that out, Crystal.
Oh, sorry. But actually deals with the needs and the desires of the American people in a way that makes them believe and has your back. Is it idealistic? Yes. Is it the only possible way forward that has any chance of working? In my view, yes.
Well, guys, congrats on the book, and I think we'll be excited. Oh, last thing, New Hampshire predictions is coming out the same day as the, what's going to happen?
The New Hampshire primary.
All right, I'm going to go 1 through 4. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it's Bernie, Pete, Warren, Biden. Biden another fourth.
I can
strong four, and not a strong fourth either.
Yeah. I'm in the same boat.
Guys, what about the Yang Gang?
I know.
They'll probably get 5%. They might come in fifth.
I think they will outperform. New Hampshire's a good place for Yang. It's a good place for Tulsi. I think they'll both outperform there. But I do think the top four, I think it's going to be a good win for Bernie. And I think it will be dang near the death knell for Biden. Did you see how I said dang? I'm trying to censor myself.
There we go. Censorship.
All right. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Marshall.
Thank you, Marshall.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Just a reminder, we also publish these episodes on YouTube, so if you want to catch a look at us as we do these episodes, it's a great place to check it out. Kristen Sager's book, The Populist Guide to 2020, A New Right and a New Left Are Rising, is out now. They also have an audiobook version which they narrated themselves, if you particularly enjoyed listening to them on the show today. As always, be sure to rate this podcast 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and share it with your friends. We'll see you next week.